I want to welcome everyone, all the audience of Psychology is Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm so excited today. I have here with me Dr. Stephen Hassan, who is an expert on probably many things by now. You've been an extremely active psychologist, you know, for over 45 years. You've had your own personal experience of being recruited into and controlled by a cult and then leaving a cult. And since then, you've continued to cultivate an expertise around the process that you experienced and the many variations thereof. So just to say quickly, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Psychology is Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that you also teach social psychology, and students need to understand that we are embodied minds and we're social creatures, and we like to think we're solitary, rational, and we're not.
Right.
And all the unconscious biases need to get conscious so that we can, you know, better regulate and negotiate. So anyway, please.
Yeah. Well, and along with speaking of the things we think about ourselves, and along with thinking that maybe we're more rational than we are sometimes, we also tend to think that we are less vulnerable than we actually are to exactly what this conversation is going to focus on, which is essentially mind control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the primary manifestation of mind control that we see or that is commonly thought of is in cults.
Mm-hmm.
But you, of course, point out the many other contexts and types of relationships where mind control is abused.
Yep.
So I thought we could organize our conversation in maybe three major sections. The process by which a person is recruited into a cult and the control of their mind is setting in, and then the process of being in a cult, the psychology of a cult, and how exactly control of a person's behavior and thoughts and emotions and exposure to information is controlled in an authoritarian manner. And then the process of leaving a cult or getting out of a situation where your mind is being controlled and kind of liberating oneself from that enslavement, from that trap, as you call it. So that can be maybe the general framing of the conversation.
Sounds great.
And throughout that, I know on many podcasts, you've shared your personal story. And given the limit of our time, I'm thinking that it would probably just work well for you to make references as examples to your personal story.
Sure.
And then anyone who wants the more detailed version can either listen to you on other interviews, or better yet, read one of your four books. And the one that I've read most closely and that I'm really drawing upon today is Combating Cult Mind Control. And I believe it's on the fourth edition. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it came out in 1988 and was published in 10 languages. And I wanted to keep updating it, but I hadn't hired a lawyer when I signed the first contract. And my publisher basically held on to the book because it kept selling. For 27 years, I finally had to buy my own book back for a lot of money, but then I was able to update it because things, you know, had changed so much with the internet and cell phones, etc. But Combating is the foundational book, and people have reported that they read the book and realized they were in a cult and walked out just from reading the book. So I'm very happy that it continues to help people.
Yes.
And I did Freedom of Mind, which is my approach to how to help a loved one or friend or someone you care about out of a cult. But I want people to read Combating first and then read Freedom of Mind. And then the most recent book I have is The Cult of Trump. I'm working on another quickie turnaround book
that I want to put out in the next few months, in fact, to explain psychological warfare, which is what's happening in our media space and on social media. Because when I was recruited into the Moonies, it was 1974, and I was at college, and women flirted with me in real life. These days, people are getting recruited online by people they have no idea who they are, but they look attractive or they are saying all the right things. And most people don't think about the fact that there are 5,000 data points on us in the dark web that can be used by bad actors to identify our profile and to know which buttons to push in what sequence using AI. So things have dramatically shifted. So I want people to protect their minds and their bodies and their family and friends to understand what's going on.
Well, you are, you know, at the forefront of providing resources to people to prevent that very thing from happening, because the shift is obviously toward giving far more power to recruiters. You know, like, even just as one concrete example you talk about, is one of the things that can sometimes really kind of sink the hook in for people is the displays of seemingly mystical experiences, or as you put it, planned spontaneity.
Well, that's what Lifton called it in 1961 when he was describing Chinese communist criteria of brainwashing.
And so
mystical manipulation, he called it. Planned spontaneity.
Oh, I had a dream about you, Nick, last night. Oh, you were struggling with some, you know, it's known as cold reading in the expose of the pseudo psychic world, the James Randis and the Michael Shermers of this world that go, hey, there's a technique here,
right? And to think how much a person could arm themselves with information found on the internet and then pretend like they are channeling that in some spiritual manner to give the impression that I'm this, you know, mystical figure that you should now follow and worship. It's scary. And on this note of, you know, kind of the importance of all of these resources and of understanding everything we're about to talk about, you know, you say a couple of things that I wanted to actually read straight from the book. One is simply repeat a couple of times that we are all vulnerable, and that you point out that there isn't really a consistent profile as far as the background of an individual who ends up joining a cult, and that it's typically more consistently a situation that the person currently finds themselves in, you know, being a crisis of some kind or a high stress situation.
Yep, situational vulnerabilities. And, you know, being an expert in social psychology, and probably most of your listeners are too, you know the fundamental attribution error, which directs people to this unconscious bias, thinking as they're trying to understand human behavior, what is it about the person that got them in? You know, Steve was weak, he was stupid, he was from a bad family, he didn't have a religious education. Instead of, his girlfriend dumped him and three women lied and flirted with him.
Exactly.
You know, and love bombed him.
Exactly.
So to realize, you know what, we are all vulnerable, we're breathing, we are open to learning and having experiences, and we don't know what we don't know. And I just want to add, if I may, Nick, in this 2024 environment, I was talking with a friend and they were like, it was so spooky. I was talking to my wife about, you know, buying this particular car, and boom, it popped up on my social media. And I'm like, did you turn off the microphone on your phone? They're being listened to right now. Yeah. Turn off my microphone. Like, yes, because they're listening and the information is being shared, because in the United States, there's no data privacy legislation like Europe has. And you know why not? Because big tech and the billionaires care more about selling our attention for advertising than they care about protecting people's well-being.
thank you for expressing that. That's a very important to realize or be reminded of regularly. And yeah, what a buzzkill, right? When you think this magical synchronistic event is actually just someone spying on you.
Well, there's a book by a Harvard professor, I forget her name, on surveillance capitalism is the title of her book. And we have now, you know, facial recognition all over the place. There's a company called Clearview that has this massive database of images so that, you know, if you have enough money to buy a license, you know, and corporations have that amount of money, governments do, they can know where Steve Hassan goes, like everywhere. And it sucks. I'm not happy about it.
No, it's deeply disturbing and dystopian. Well, again, all of this is really just underscoring the importance of being aware of mind control techniques. And to further underscore it, I thought I'd read just two quotes directly from the book. One, here in chapter 3, you say that the average person doesn't understand mind control, doesn't know how cults operate, doesn't know what questions to ask and what behaviors to watch out for, and doesn't believe they could ever be sucked in. That's why so many ordinary people are prime candidates for cult recruiters. And I'll read one more here also in chapter 3. You can find the exact spot. Like it or not, everyone is vulnerable to mind control. Everyone wants to be happy. Everyone needs affection and attention. Everyone is looking for something better in life, more wisdom, more knowledge, more money, more status, more meaning, better relationships, or better health. And these basic human qualities and needs are exactly what cult recruiters prey upon. So, this is the segue into kind of that first section that I said we'd discuss, which is the process by which a person is recruited into a cult. You emphasize very strongly, no one, of course, decides to join a cult. People are recruited into organizations under false pretenses, and it ends up being a cult. And so there's you know, several different questions I have, but I'd like to ask first, and if you don't mind, a little preamble to the question. I think everyone who studies psychology understands that when it comes to behavioral conditioning, we are incentivized by what we want, and particularly what we want but don't have, the unmet needs, the things that we are not yet satisfied with. And so, of course, you know, a person who's very, very rich, it's very hard to persuade them with money. But if a person who's rich and very lonely, you'll have much more leverage if you persuade them with connection and belonging. So as I read your story of being recruited into the Unification Church cult, I was looking for what it was among all the universal human needs that really seemed to have the strongest lure on you. And I made a few notes, but I'm curious to just hear you remember and reflect upon what was it that you think had the strongest lure for you as you were being recruited into this organization?
It's a great question. And may I just say, to be scholarly about it, there's a ton of people born into cults. So it's not just recruited into cults.
Right.
That's more my story, but I work with a ton. We call them second generation or third generation, where they are angry because they say, I never joined. I didn't have a choice. So, and as a therapist helping people, it's more challenging to help them figure out who they are versus, in my case, I was 19 years old. I had very clear values and beliefs and goals. to the extent I can be as objective as I can on my consciousness, as a 19-year-old, there were things that were outside of my range of experience, and it made me curious. So I'd say that was definitely my desire to know and understand, and my curiosity, because I had traveled
to a number of countries. I was curious to get to know people from other countries, and the Moonies had people from 12 different countries, I think, at that center when I came. So that was like, wow, people from 12 different countries living together. That's interesting. You know, that there must be something that is pulling all these different cultures and beliefs and religious backgrounds together. That was something. I also want to say something my father thought he was helping me out with, because my father owned a hardware store. I was brought in to work there and taught to sell things to people. And he said, "Steve, you can always tell when people are lying by their eyes. Like, if someone's lying, their eyes are shifty." And I really believed that until after I got out of the Moonies and I was thinking back, because the women were just making incredible eye contact, looking right through me. And they lied their face off, but they were so believable. And it was so innocuous sounding that it got past my defense system. So that was another interesting piece. Another thing, honestly, reflecting back is the exuding of certainty.
Yeah.
Was something, because, you know, in the real world, real people, they say, well, I believe this, but there's always, you're always open. There's some doubt, you know, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong or whatever. But this is a universal that I keep coming across with cult true believers, that they are so certain that it makes you feel like this, there's something missing in you, that you don't have, you can't walk around with that level of certainty about reality. So that was a bit, again, triggering my curiosity. And then there was the camaraderie piece that was also unusual for me. I had been in different, I was on a basketball team, a chorus at school, college, in classes, but there was something like, hey, we have the inside track on things, and you may or may not be spiritual enough to be ready for it, but, you know, maybe you are. And that's another thing I want to say about my recruitment. They didn't say Moon is the Messiah, bow to the floor, he's 10 times greater than Jesus. I come from a Jewish background. I would have run if they had even said church or Christian or a Korean, you know, messianic figure. It was always like, we're living in very special times. Have you noticed, Steve? Yeah. Things are getting really heated up, and there's a lot of conflict in the world. And so you're writing poetry, right? You want to be a professor and teach creative writing? That's honorable. That's nice. But the world, it seems like it needs a lot more than that, Steve. Are you sure you're living up to your full potential?
Yeah.
So there's that, you know, not attacking my beliefs and my value systems, but again, this conveying of there may be a greater plan here. Are you open to the possibilities? And again, knowing what I know now, and this is, I'm going to skip to the third section for a second. I hope you don't mind now.
Not at all.
But what I often ask my clients, once they learn about the influence continuum and bite model and they understand the frames, I ask them to imagine going back to when they were first recruited. If you could go back knowing then what you know now, what would you have said and done differently? Mm. And everybody goes, I would have told them to go F themselves, or I would have run in the other direction. I never would have asked her out. I never would have gone on that dating app or whatever. And I'm bringing it up because the critical thing that I want to convey, and I want your listeners to be leaving this talk more optimistically than pessimistically, is we have neuroplasticity, we have neurogenesis, and we can learn, and we can protect ourselves, and we can heal ourselves in very dramatic ways if we understand how the neuroscience works, and if we understand that if we tell somebody, don't think of a white horse, they think of a white horse. When a clinician says, don't think of your trauma, you think more of your trauma. It amplifies. And to say, remember before you had the trauma, what your body felt like, you know, remember those states of consciousness, or can you imagine in the future, everything's healed, and how integrated you feel, and how grounded you feel in your body, and how confident you feel, and yet the locus of control for your life is in you, and not you're not looking outside for someone else to tell you what's true and what to believe and how, you know, and how to live your life. So there's such powerful human beings are extraordinary, and I just love to meet people and learn from them because everybody's different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not only learning different strategies and how people overcame all kinds of adversities, but just being grateful that we're alive. Mm-hmm. You know, as a cancer survivor.
Mm.
17 years later, I'm feeling great. I just came back from my yearly physical, and my blood work was perfect, and my blood pressure is great, and I'm like, thank you. I'm about to turn 70.
Yes,
I'm doing this hard trauma work, but I'm also trying to stay grounded as much as possible and enjoy my life.
Mm.
So back to the techniques. I want to explain. Deception is outright lying, withholding vital information, and distorting information to make it palatable. And with all of those things, walk through the world believing people, trusting people, but also pay attention, because if your gut or you have an inkling something's off, pay attention and follow up with a question.
Mm-hmm.
So you told me that you're not religious at all. In other words, if I'm in the group for 3 months or 6 months or a year, there's not going to be any surprises. We're not going to be reading a scripture. We're not going to be bowing to an altar. We're not going to be meditating or praying or chanting or yoging or anything else like that. So what I'm trying to say is use your language to probe. Ask direct questions and wait for a direct answer to your question. Because if it's a questionable group, they'll try to change the topic, deflect it, turn it back on you. What's wrong? You're so untrusting, Steve. And I'm like, no, I'm just a good consumer.
Yeah.
You know, my time is very valuable. You're wanting my time. I want to know who I'm talking to. Don't tell me the name of a group, but it's actually one of 700 front groups. And just like learn how to be assertive, to ask questions, because I say if it's legitimate, it will stand up to scrutiny. And if it's not legitimate, why waste your time and energy?
And you offer, it's in chapter 7 of Combating the Cult Mind Control book, that you provide concrete, exact questions that people can take with them and maybe...
Yeah, tell me about your leader.
Yes.
Yeah. Is your leader the Messiah or a prophet who claims to talk to God or an apostle? By the way, we have 40 to 50 million Americans who are following an apostle or a prophet who claims to speak directly to God. This is part of the political problem we have in the United States, because these people were told by their prophet that Trump won the election in 2020, when there's all evidence to the contrary. But these people are going to follow God's words, because Satan is everywhere else. So this is part of the situation we find ourselves in. And the media keeps calling these folks Christian evangelicals when they're not, in my opinion. They're members of mind control cults.
That gives you a sense of the scale of the problem.
Is it?
You describe cult recruiters as being like con artists, but then you go on to say that the difference between a con artist and a cult recruiter is that the con artist wants your money and then leaves, but the cult recruiter cons you and wants more than your money. They want your money too, but they want your mind, is what you say.
But what's different is that the cult recruiter is a true believer. And so they are replicating the lie done to them on you, thinking they're doing you a favor by saving your soul or 10 generations of your ancestors. And so I was a very effective recruiter because I was a true believer. I had swallowed the ideology hook, line, and sinker, and here's another piece of really important information for your listeners. And I didn't understand this for 4 years after I got out of the cult, but I learned about phobias when I started my mental health training, and I was like, phobias. Ooh, irrational fears. Ooh, when I think back to the Moonies, what was put in my head and when? And I remember being taken to see the Exorcist movie in 1974 with other Moonies in Greenwich Village. We went up in vans to Tarrytown to hear the Messiah, who gave a lecture how God made this movie. And this movie was a prophecy of what would happen if you left the church. And it was like, that's when I stopped having doubts, because I was petrified of being, you know, invaded by demons that I never believed existed prior to this. But I was so afraid of what I saw in that film. And so many cults, Nick, use the Matrix movie, by the way. ISIS, to name one, but many other cults use the Matrix and the Red Pill and all the QAnon conspiracy stuff that you think you know what reality is, but you're in a simulation, or you're in an alternate reality. We'll tell you what the real reality is when you're ready.
When you're ready. And that's something I notice you emphasize a lot too, is the very strategic, gradual exposure to the ideology of the cults, like you said.
Incremental.
Yes. Because, and I think you used the metaphor, maybe you were saying that Scientology uses the metaphor of you can't feed a baby steak.
Yeah, the Moonies told me that, but many cults use the same thing. You have to feed them formula. You have to give them what they're ready to swallow. You don't want anyone having doubts. That's not what they say, but that's the implication, is you want something, you know, step by step by step. And you know that the metaphor about the frog in hot water has been debunked, right? But in terms of cults, it really fits.
Yeah.
Because if you're gradually being asked to do a different behavior, a different behavior, a different behavior, what cognitive dissonance theory teaches us is that you change the behavior, you rationalize it, in order to feel better about it. And that can be used in a good way to teach new skills and train clinicians and researchers. And it can be used to create a pseudo identity or dissociative disorder
that's dependent and obedient and forever childlike in their psychology.
And that is exactly what you say is kind of the key feature of mind control, is that it encourages dependency and obedience and discourages individuality.
Right, but I'll clarify, there really is a dissociative disorder, and most other people who do cult education don't understand that as a mental health professional. It's in the DSM-5, it was in the DSM-4, it's number 300.15. It explicitly talks about cults, brainwashing, coercive persuasion, and it talks about it as a disruption of identity. And so when people, for example, get in the cult of Trump, family members and pundits say, oh, they're brainwashed, nothing can get them out of it. And I categorically say, you don't know what you're talking about. And I talk about, you know, like me, the real Steve, and then the Mooney Steve, and how in my deprogramming, I came back to life, and I remembered all this crap that happened in the Moonies that I wasn't allowed to think of as a true believer, that did thought stopping and phobias. But I remembered a whole lot of stuff that in any normal environment would have made me run to the authorities, even. Because back in the 74, Moon was saying that democracy was satanic. We have to infiltrate Congress. We need to change the Constitution and make it a capital offense for people not to follow God's will. This is what I believed in 1974. When Moon said we're going to go and fast for 3 days for Richard Nixon during Watergate, I hated Nixon. I thought he was a criminal. And now I'm fasting for 3 days because God wants him to be president despite Watergate. I mean, my mind was hacked. But the key thing is, the real Steve was still in there. Right. I was still recognizing things that didn't add up, but I just had to keep doing thought stopping until my accident and then my deprogramming. And in my deprogramming, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to prove to my family that I wasn't in a cult and I wasn't brainwashed. No, so it was really that motivation of certainty. No one can deprogram me because I'm not programmed. I'm following God.
I want to get into a few things that you just brought up. The role, phobias, instilling phobias. I think that's an extremely interesting topic. The role of, like the BITE model of authoritarian control and what that looks like on each of these different levels, and the role of dissonance theory in that. And then as well as deprogramming and exiting cults.
Sure.
So maybe I'll start by reading another thing that you wrote. So the other thing I was going to bring up is hypnosis and, programming a person's unconscious mind, essentially. I want to hear more your explanation on that. So to the topic of phobias first.
We need 5 hours.
I know.
I'm teasing.
You're probably right.
I'll try to talk fast.
What do phobias have to do with cult groups and mind control, you say? In some cults, members are systematically made to be phobic about ever leaving the group. Today's cults know how to effectively implant vivid negative images deep within members' unconscious minds, making it impossible for them to ever conceive of ever being happy and successful outside the group. And there's a particular example that you provide in the book that I thought was just unforgettable to me and very powerful and tragic, which was, you talk about it later in the book, and it's this woman that you just were having a conversation with, I think a friend of a friend, and you're having a conversation with her at dinner. She's talking about how she was spent only about 3 months being recruited into the Unification Church.
In the Moonies, yeah.
Yeah. And then now she's at a point where she wants to have kids, but she's afraid to do so. And then you, through conversation, expose that part of the recruitment process was instilling the phobia that anyone who leaves the cult, leaves the organization, you know, it would be their fate to have a stillborn child. And then how revelatory that was for her.
Yeah, she dropped her glass.
Wow.
We were at a party at my house in Georgetown. It was 1981. I just started Ex-Members Against Moon as a nonprofit. And she heard I was in the Moonies. She said, oh, I was in them. You know, I left them a few years ago. And then later in the conversation, and it must have been, you know, her own unconscious going, but she just started riffing about how, you know, she and her husband really wanted to have kids, but she had all these fears around it. She just verbalized it. And I said, you know, I know you were only in for 3 months, but do you remember they told us that if we left, you know, and had children, one of the things would be that they would be stillborn or you know, have very serious physical problems. And she dropped her glass. Mm-hmm. She hadn't remembered it.
Wow. Well, I want to understand better from you. How can an individual plant such a phobia, such a belief into a person's unconscious mind? Can you explain to us how that works?
I can do my best. So I'll say that when I first got out of the Moonies, I started reading books on brainwashing and mind control. I went and saw Robert Lifton, who was, I credit for my entire career, because he, you know, I was a depressed ex-Moonie college dropout with a cast from my toes to my groin. And I'm telling him about how the Moonies operated. And he looked me in the eyes. He said, you know, I just know this secondhand, but you've lived it. They did it to you and you did it to other people. What you're describing is more sophisticated than what the Chinese were doing. So you should study psychology and explain it to me. In any case, it was about 4 years after that point that I was invited by a friend to attend a hypnosis workshop. And I was curious what it was. I always thought of it as the watch going back and forth, stage hypnosis type things. But I had read endless numbers of books and articles on persuasion and brainwashing, but there was a missing ingredient. And so when I heard about this workshop, I wanted to attend and learn what is hypnosis. And I remember, because it was the first workshop outside of a college environment that I attended, and I was very skeptical and afraid, honestly, because of the Moonies experience. I was like deliberately pacing in the back. Then, like, I didn't want to sit. I didn't want to close my eyes. I wanted to stay meta to what was being presented. But as it was being presented, I'm like, I used to do that in the Moonies, talking in a very special way that was very eliciting of feelings and images. And so I was like, I need to understand this stuff. And it really is about, in a sense, capturing people's imagination and in a concentration absorption way, absorbed way. In other words, the way I think about it, it bypasses your critical data analysis part of your brain,
yeah,
and just goes into your zone experience flow state. And I had experience flow states as a poet. Like, when I got into my writer's mode, words just came out. I didn't analyze them. Later I would edit and analyze, but whole poems would show up. And in fact, when I wrote Combating, I was under deadline. I wanted to get the book out for the 10th anniversary of Jonestown, and I kept delaying, and the publisher said, I need the manuscript in 6 weeks. And I wrote the book in 6 weeks. Wow. I just got up at 5:30 and I wrote all day. Went to the bathroom, ate, and wrote for 6 weeks. And we moved one chapter from here to there, but otherwise it just needed copy editing. It just came out. So I know about flow states, and this, it's not rational. And where does it come from? Well, I'm learning maybe it's the right hemisphere from Ian McGilchrist. I don't know if you know his work, but I'm totally obsessed with him now in the last few weeks of learning about his work. But the point is about hypnosis is it's not sleep. It's a focusing and concentration of attention. And when I was invited to be on the Center for Humane Technologies podcast, Your Undivided Attention, this is the people who are ethicists at Google and have been trying to say we need to have guidelines and boundaries and regulations for social media. What was very clear is that it's creating a hypnotic state to be on these platforms where we lose time, because that's one of the features of being in a hypnotic trance, is you have what's called time distortion. And people report, well, I just went on Instagram for 5 minutes and 2 hours later, I'm still on Instagram. Well, that's not an accident. That's designed. That goes back to BJ Fogg and the Stanford Persuasive Lab, who taught them how to do likes and dislikes and how to do, and Asa Raskin came up with doom scrolling, where there's no, you know, 10 results and then you have to click to go to the next page. No, you can just keep scrolling forever and ever. And so what I'm trying to convey is what's happening now is people's unconscious is getting infiltrated by things that they're not conscious of. And that can be auditory signals, that can be visual signals that are faster than our conscious mind can see. And by the way, the Exorcist movie that I cited a moment ago was the first film that I'm aware of that had subliminals of the devil deliberately put into that movie to make people even more afraid.
Interesting.
And there's no regulations against hypnosis online. And I'm involved with clinical hypnotherapists, ethical, because it's a fantastic tool for learning and growing and developing skills. But it's so easy to be co-opted without your awareness.
Makes
and
sense.
People are going to yoga and they're having guided visualizations, and the person who's teaching the yoga class is in a cult and just putting in a few ideas here and there each session.
Mm-hmm. And I think I'm understanding that, you know, the key is that there's a suspending of critical thinking faculties.
Yeah, or it's bypassing your normal defense systems. Yeah. Like a normal defense system is, wait a minute, I was told never to give my credit card to a stranger on the telephone, no matter how good the story is. Like if you have that prime in your mind, and that's why I wrote Combating. I want people to have primes, red flags.
Yeah.
Ooh, that reminds me of what Hassan said. Sounds like a phobia. Warning.
Right.
Danger, Will Robinson, to quote Lost in Space, right, for those old enough to remember that.
I got the reference. So I'm aware of the time and it's flying by, and I know that you only have so much time. So I want to kind of maybe pick and choose here of my bullet points. There's a few things that I thought were particularly interesting that I haven't heard you be asked about necessarily on other interviews.
Sure.
And so I'll just kind of direct people to your website, Freedom of Mind, and your book, of course, for a great list of examples of what you mean when you talk about the BITE model of authoritarian control, which, as people have heard us say, stands for behavior, information, thought, and emotion. And you just do a great job of providing very specific examples of how, of what type of control tactics are used within each of those categories.
Sure.
So as much as I would love to talk about that in more length,
sure.
What instead I'll do is just kind of direct people to that and raise a question.
And this, the influence continuum,
yes.
Because it's backwards. It's BITE is the unethical side of things versus the ethical side of things. For example, sleep deprivation. Yeah. We need 7 to 9 hours of sleep. I was sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night, every single night in the Moonies. How can you think critically when you're not sleeping enough, right? Change of clothing, change of name, change of diet, rigid rules and regulations, punishments for disobeying a rule, and praise for following the rule. But the bottom line is being dependent and obedient is behavior control. That's the goal of it.
Right.
And information control, lying, withholding information, distorting information, having people spy on you and share information with leadership in conversations that you had with them or the initial recruiter had with you. Oh, by the way, his parents are divorced. His sister died in a tragic car accident, whatever. And then the cult leader can, you know, have a Bible study and let's pray. And, oh, somebody in the room had a tragic accident with their sister. Like, let's pray for, you know, and the person is like, oh, my God, God is in the room, right, or whatever. So that kind of information that's used a lot of. Propagandizing, as well as programming people never to trust the former member or a critic or read anything critical. And I say if it's legitimate, it will stand up to scrutiny. So if you want to know whether you're in a mind control cult, deliberately seek out critics and former members,
right,
and trust your intelligence and ability to ask for evidence of what they're saying.
Right.
And you know, you'll be able to tell because, you know, really, I promise. And thought control, when you're in a cult, it's black and white, us versus them, good versus evil, very simplistic. And it's not a map teaching the truth. It is the truth with a capital T, so you can't question it at all. You're taught to do thought stopping. Chanting, praying, meditating, if any doubt comes into your mind. Loaded language. Language is from Lifton and is 8 criteria from Chinese communist brainwashing. But words are the tools we use to think. And words should serve us to help understand the complexity of reality, not become short, platitudinous words that nobody else understands except members of the group. Just to give you a few examples. And then the emotional control, making you feel so special. You're part of the chosen, you're part of the elite, but most of it is guilt and fear manipulation. And the universal is the phobia indoctrination. So I say, Nick, if someone has a really serious phobia of elevators, they can't imagine getting in an elevator riding safely and comfortably. They can only generate negative movies of plummeting to their death or being trapped for eternity. And their heart rate goes up. They get a cold sweat. If you're in a mind control cult and you have a phobia against leaving, you can't imagine leaving and being happy and fulfilled. Or if it's a spiritual, religious type cult, you're in hell, or you know, you've lost God because they control God as if God could be controlled by any human being. But the point is it's all fixable. You know, phobias are one of the fastest mental illnesses to help people get over. But the critical thing is understanding we need to have fear against things that are dangerous, and we need our rational mind to assess, is there actual danger or not? And what's the risk of the danger? There's actually a very good book on statistics of risk by, I think it's David Ropeek.
Okay.
it's much more dangerous to get in a car and drive than almost anything else statistically, right? But people get in the car, in cars and drive all the time. You don't think twice about it.
Yeah.
But if you're in a church and you think, I might like to go to the church down the road because they have a childcare program and this one doesn't, or I like the preacher better, you get so afraid, or you get afraid that you're going to be shunned, what's called dispensing of existence, or to use a popular term, cancel culture. This I learned from 1961. Lifton wrote about dispensing of existence. If you're in the party, you have a right to exist. And if you leave, anything can be done to you because you're not a real person anymore because you've left the party.
Kind of the prototype term for what is now considered cancel culture, the dispensing of existence.
It is cancel culture on the left and the right. Both of them are an element of mind control. And I reject cancel culture of anyone, and people try to cancel me all the time. The atheists try to cancel me because I believe in God, and the religious people cancel me because I'm not religious enough. And, you know, I just need to be true to myself,
right,
and go to sleep at night knowing that I had a good day and I contributed, and I'm blessed to have friends and family and meaningful work.
Speaking of you being true to yourself, something that really stood out to me about the psychology of everything you talk about is, I'll go ahead and just read two short passages from your book that express what I'm getting at. So you wrote, as much as cult indoctrination attempts to destroy and suppress the old identity and empower the new one, it almost never totally succeeds. Good experiences and positive memories rarely disappear entirely. The cult identity will try to bury former reference points and submerge the person's past. Yet over time, the old self will eventually exert itself and seek ways to regain freedom. And this process is speeded up by positive exposure to non-members and the accumulation of bad experiences the person has while in the group. And then you say the real identity, deep down, the hardware self beneath the mind control virus, sees and records contradictions, questions, and disillusioning experiences. And if there is much in this book, especially the chapter on courageous survivor stories, but there's much that offers hope. As much as you emphasize that we're all vulnerable to mind control, there is so much room for hope here. And this is one of them. You know, the idea that as thoroughly controlled and programmed as a person may be, their authentic self, the real them, is still in there. And something that I thought was so beautiful about your story of deprogramming, as you put it, or exiting the cult, was that it seemed by my read that what initially cracked the edifice of the defenses that the cult had put in place for you was witnessing your father cry for only the second time in your whole life.
True.
And that was really powerful to me because it was like, wow, like your father's genuine emotion there was what sort of reached in past all of that programming and grabbed the hand of his real son.
Yep.
And began to
pull. He asked me to step into his shoes, and how would I feel if it was my son who met a group that was controversial and disappeared from your life, didn't show up for holidays or birthdays or Father's Days? How would you feel? And the tear. And I was like, I would feel like you're feeling. And then my cult self said, oh, but he's been brainwashed by the communist media against father. But then my real self was like, what can I do to put you out of pain, Dad, to reassure you? He said, I just want you to hear the other side. And if you want to go back at the end of 5 days, I'll drive you there myself. But at least your mother and I will be able to sleep at night, knowing we did the responsible thing. And with that, I was like, I want to prove that I'm not in a cult, because to allay their fears, they've been worrying for no reason. And damn, I had to put my tail between my legs and cried for 3 hours when I realized it really wasn't a cult. I was really gone.
Yeah, well, I really admire, you know, the way you share your story and all, just there's so many things that I appreciate about your work and that I think are so important. And truthfully, there was like, you know, 25 more bullet points of talking points that
you'll have to invite me back for part two.
Don't you tempt me with a good time.
Well, I enjoyed this. I appreciate when people read my work a lot, because most people don't have time or whatever.
Well, thank you. And I mean, I will. And I can assure the audience and you that I will be reaching out to you to speak again. And maybe this was just the first conversation of ours. And I've enjoyed it tremendously. And I want to respect your time. And we've been speaking for an hour now. So I know you have to go do your next thing. But I want to thank you on behalf of the whole Psychology as audience for sharing your expertise. And I think it's fair to say I look forward to speaking with you again.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope to have a new book out in the next few months. So I'll hit you up then. How's
beautiful.
That?
Sounds great.
And I'll send you an advanced copy. So just to finish, I have a podcast called The Influence Continuum, and we have a blog as well as the audio version. And I've started a Substack, and I did an online course to teach more. It's 9 hours for clinicians, but I have a version for everyone else who just wants to know this thing. And there are tens of millions of former members of cults, of narcissistic parent, abusive relationship, bad CEO. It's everywhere these days. So the important thing is to realize our mind is our most precious resource, and trusted people in the real world, people who we know, friends, family, we need to have trust pods and support each other, because the way it looks to me, Nick, resilience and flexibility and adaptability are going to be key themes going forward in the world to come.
Excellent closing remarks. Well, once again, thank you. And I look forward to speaking with you again. Good luck on completing this new writing process that you're engaged in and all of the other things that you're doing.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Take care.